accession number 26731, Reel 1.
Leonard Vincent Knowles, Reel 1. Can I start by asking you when you were born and where that was?
12th of June 1928, in Southampton.
And can you tell me a little bit about your background? What did your family do?
Well, my father was a painter, employed mainly in Southampton Docks. And it was mainly casual work in those days. The ship would come in, they would employ painters for 2 or 3 days, then lay them off again. Well, that was the background to most of the shipyard workers in Southampton. It was always casual work. You could work for them for 2 or 3 years and be retained all that time, but once you spoke out of turn, you were out. As happened to me after the war when I was employed down there as an electrician in the docks.
Where did you live? What sort of home did you have?
We had a terraced house down in the bottom of Southampton, in the St Mary's area, which is now pretty notorious in the criminal sense, but it was a respectable working class area in those days. There were five of us, five children, three boys and two girls. I was the youngest of the three boys, and the two girls, they still live. They're younger than I am. As I said...
How many bedrooms did you have?
Oh, there was just...
What sort of facilities did they have?
Pretty poor. It was an outside toilet, three bedrooms, no bathroom. And we lived there until November 1940. But it was really the bombing that drove us out, because the Germans came back on three successive Saturday nights, and the third Saturday night, the bombs were very, very close to the house, and the whole building was shaken up. The windows came in, the ceilings came down. There's no gas, no electricity, no water. So we were very fortunate at the time. We had a car.
Were you actually in the house when that happened?
We were in the shelter. We had a shelter in the back garden. It wasn't an Anderson shelter as such. They couldn't supply us with an Anderson shelter because there was a sewage pipe apparently under the back garden. So they built this concrete shelter for us in the back garden. And we spent many nights in there.
Can you describe that?
Well, it was concrete, about 6 by 8 inside, I suppose. And there were seven of us in there.
Were there any beds or...
Started off with two bunks, but these two bunks took up too much room. I was on the top bunk for the early part of the Blitz. And that's always given me a certain sense of claustrophobia. I was on this top bunk, and the concrete ceiling was just above my head. And it always gave me a very uneasy feeling. Well, anyway, as I say, the house was shaken up badly.
Well, what was it like to just trying to establish your what it was like to be in that shelter and to experience the bombing of Southampton?
It was exciting for a child. I was 12 years old. For a child, it was exciting more than scary. My mother was petrified, but not so much for herself, but for us children. I suppose the worst parts were when you were in bed, you're having a good night's sleep, the sirens went, and your parents dragged you out of bed, which they're doing the right thing, down to the shelter, and there was a broken sleep as much as anything that used to really upset you. Where we lived in Edward Street, it was right on the back of the old Poor Law Institute, the workhouse as such. And that building was shaken up by the bombing. And that following morning, they had all these old people out on the pavement outside on stretchers. They evacuated them to the hospital at West End. So I don't think it was used much after that. Anyway, my parents decided that they didn't really want to stop there. So we all got into the car, went out to the New Forest. and we found temporary lodgings at No Man's Land. We moved with about two or three different people took us in. Until the end, my parents were able to hire or rent a bungalow from a serviceman who was recently a widower. He was posted to Iceland, and this bungalow was empty. And all his furniture was put into one of the bedrooms, and we had the rest of the bungalow for the rest of the war, which was quite a bonus. I left school in 42.
Can you remember much about the school days?
School days?
Yes.
Out there? Well, I was a very, very sickly child. I could not stand bus travel. And as a senior, as a 12-year-old, I was supposed to go from No Man's Land to Daunton by bus every day, which was a 4-mile trip. And I just couldn't take the bus travel, so I had to finish my education, such as it was, in the junior school in No Man's Land. There were two of us actually were in the same sort of boat. So the last years of my education weren't much at all. I was more or less left to my own devices. But when I left school, I went to work in the forest, in forestry work and in the sawmills.
So you're 14 when you left school?
14, yes. When I was 16 and a half, I was taken on as an apprentice by the firm that used to employ my eldest brother. And we left No Man's Land on the election day in 1945.
Were any of your family in the services?
Yes, my eldest brother, Leslie, joined the RAF about 1941. He served in India and Ceylon. And he was demobbed in 1946 on I think it was called a B release. His employer had to apply for him to be released as an electrician. He had wanted to be released earlier than anyone else. I've kept the exact terms of it now, but if he hadn't had that, if that application hadn't gone in, he would have been in there quite a considerable time longer. My other brother, Harry, he was called up about 43, I think, into the Coldstream Guards. He was sent to Normandy in July 44. After D-Day, and he spent the winter of 44-45 fighting in Holland and Germany. He crossed the Rhine in March 28th, on March 26th, and he was killed in action on the 28th. And this really sticks, really, that he was killed at the age of 20, and had he lived, he would not have been entitled to vote in the 1945 election, because the age then was 21. Well, that's obviously upset my mother a lot. I wasn't enlisted until 1946, just after my 18th birthday. At the time, I was serving this apprenticeship.
During the war, did you do anything towards the war effort?
I was in the Home Guard in No Man's Land.
Can you describe the organisation of the Home Guard and what your role within it was?
Well, at that time, of course, they made all sorts of jokes about the Home Guard. The Home Guard will always be a figure of fun because of Dad's army and all this business about they were armed with pikes and so forth. But when I joined, they were very well equipped. They had Sten guns, rifles, everything. And it wasn't as funny as it is now made out to be, because before I joined in 1941, there was actually a fatality with that platoon. One of the villagers was killed on an exercise. As I say, I was I lied about my age, or two or three of us. I was age, I think, 15 at the time, but I'd shot up, I was quite tall. It wasn't much of a lie, because all the village knew how old we actually were. And I was supplied with a rifle. I had a rifle and 60 rounds of ammunition, and a uniform. And we were, each village had its own platoon, No Man's Land had a platoon, the village of Landford and White Parish and so forth, all coming under the control of headquarters in Romsey, I think it was at the time. We were stood down at the end of 1944, when it was pretty obvious that, you know, we weren't needed anymore.
How often did you meet as a platoon, and what sort of duties did you have?
Oh, every Sunday morning, and every night there were at least two or three of the platoon on standby in the village hall. We also had to at least one or two meetings of the whole platoon during the week in the village hall, or on the green if it's during the summer.
And what was your role as a member of the Home Guard?
Well, I was just an infantryman. Nothing special. Well, actually, I was supposed to be in the signal section, but that was really a waste of time because we had no signals equipment. I didn't quite know what to do with us youngsters. But it kept us out of mischief, I suppose.
Did you have to go on patrols or anything like that?
Not really, no. As I say, there's always two or three of us every night on call at the village hall. But we just used to stay in there and sleep in overnight in the village hall. But there were one or two night exercises in the forest.
Were there any incidents that called upon the Home Guard?
There was one incident whereby the airfield at Stony Cross, which was about 2 miles away from No Man's Land, was occupied by the American Air Force, and they stated they'd seen a parachute descending in the forest. And we set out as a patrol to cover this piece of forest, but we never found anything. That was the only real incident, I suppose, that was different from our training.
Did you receive any pay for being there?
Oh, no, nothing at all, no. No, we had a rifle backed up on top of what's known as Piper's Weight in the New Forest. We used to go shooting there for Sunday morning. And on other occasions, we went to Romsey, to the rifle bats there, the quite extensive rifle bats at Romsey at the time. And we also attended lectures and film shows at the Plaza Cinema in Romsey. So, not really a lot to say about it, really. Just that last year in the Echo, they published a photograph of the platoon, which was quite a surprise to open the Echo and see all the people from the platoon there. And someone in No Man's Land had written a history of the whole village, and it featured this photograph, and it stated that this was the Home Guard in 1940. Well, I wrote to this fellow and said, well, that's not the Home Guard in 1940, that's 1944, because I was in it in 44, and that was the photograph taken immediately before we stood down. And in the letter, I picked him up about one or two things in his book, and he's since written back to me saying that the people I mentioned are anxious to get in touch with me. But one of them actually phoned up last week trying to arrange an appointment, but he hasn't been back to me since.
So you stood down, Home Guard was stood down at the end of
1944? End of 1944, yes.
You were working in forestry.
Forestry and sawmill, and sawmills, yeah. Actually, I worked in the sawmill, and I was doing the job on a saw bench that the man did before me and the man did after me. And I was what, 15, 16 years old at that time, and I believe I was earning as much as my father was, working as the painter in the docks. But certainly hardened me up. It was hard work for a lad of that age. But as I say, I shot up. I was 6 foot in no time at all.
Do you have any other memories of the war and the end of the war? Do you remember that?
Well, the most vivid memory of the war really is the day they bombed the Supermarine Works at Woolston, because I was at school, in Deanery School in Southampton, which is what, across the river, is a quarter of a mile from the Supermarine Spitfire Works. We had no air raid shelter as such. What they'd done was reinforce one of the corridors with extra steel beams in the ceiling, and all the windows were blanked off, and we were in this corridor when those bombs dropped. And one was quite near to the school gate. It actually hit the level crossing at Chapel Road, and entirely wrecked the local sweet shop. And we were in this shelter waiting for the raid to end, and they brought through the young woman and her two children from the sweet shop, absolutely smothered in dust and debris. But it really struck me at the time that there's all these boys, 12 and 13, about 50 or 60 of us in this shelter, and they didn't make a sound. No panic, nothing. And the masters relaxed the normal discipline of the schoolroom, and they were encouraging people to do their party piece, and they were actually reading out from comics to us to calm us. Well, we didn't need calming down, because it was, as I say, there was no panic at all. But that's the most vivid memory, I think.
And that would have been in about 1940?
September 1940.
Yes. Do you remember the end of the war? Any celebrations locally or?
Well, I was.
How you felt when the news was announced?
Well, it was pretty muted for us, really, because with my brother dying, so there's no real great celebration. But the rest of the family, we went some. Walking through the centre of Southampton with the celebrations that went on then, and the bonfires that were being lit, because all the way down above Bar and the High Street were all these bomb sites, and you had just a wooden barrier between the pavements and the road and the cellars, and there these bonfires going in what were the cellars in above Bar. But as I say, for our family, it was pretty subdued. I've got more relations than that. My mother's had five stepsisters, and they were their husbands and so forth, and went through the entire war without a scratch until, as I say, my brother died. So it's very muted.
Did your family return to Southampton after the war, or did you continue in no man's land?
No, we came back on the election day, 1945, that was July. My mother managed to find this house to rent in Oxford Avenue. And the family remained there until my mother died in about 52. But I was It was from there that I joined the RAF in 46.
You were called up as a national service?
Oh, yes. As they used to say, I received a cunningly worded offer of employment.
Can you describe what happened to you once you'd been called up?
Well, it comes as a bit of a shock, really, because you don't, until you get in that barrack room, you don't realise the number of things you rely on your mother for. You grow up very quickly. And it's quite an experience meeting people from other lads from all over the country, Midlands, the North, London and so forth.
Did you have any choice about which service you joined?
I don't think I did. I think I may have preferred to go in the RAF because my brother had been in it.
Where were you sent once you had been called up? What were your first memories?
First memories was Padgate near Warrington. That's where all RAF recruits were sent at that time. It was there that they sorted you out with a medical. They gave you interviews as to which trade you were suitable for and equipped you with your uniform and so forth. We were there for about 10 days, 2 weeks, I suppose.
Were you allocated to any particular trade?
Yes, wireless fitter. I'd been serving as an apprentice electrician and I'd been to night school studying the subject. So my background, educational background was very, very poor due to the war. But with the night school lessons, I just acquired enough knowledge to get onto the wireless fitter's course, which is very fortunate. But first of all, we had to go to basic training, or square backing, as we called it.
Do you remember what that entailed?
Mainly drill, aircraft recognition, so forth. Mainly drill, lots of drill, discipline. And that was at Wilmslow, south of Manchester. I think we were there for either 6 to 8 weeks. From there, we split up into various units, and I was sent down to Yatesbury in Wiltshire, up on the Marlborough Downs, near Marlborough, for the first 5 months of the basic wireless fitter training.
Can you describe your training, what that involved?
Well, you'd get a lecture, and you'd go to another lab and use a practical demonstration of the electrical components you'd just been lectured about, and so on and so on. They built you right up. After 5 months, if you passed that part of the course, you had the choice of becoming either a radar fitter or a wireless fitter. Well, if you chose the radar fitter option, you stayed at Yatesbury. And Yatesbury was a pretty bleak place. So I chose the wireless fitter option, which meant that I was sent to Cranwell in Lincolnshire, the radio school up there. But this was the winter, the very cold winter of 46, 47. The whole place, most of the RAF stations and army stations, a lot of them closed down that winter because of the fuel shortage. But Yatesbury remained open.
What were living conditions like? Where did you sleep and eat?
Well, we had these barrack blocks, about 30 men to each barrack block. And it was pretty cold. Pretty cold. Every item of clothing, your great coat and your spare uniform, you put on top of you at night to keep warm. Food was pretty plentiful. It was a bit bland, but there was a lot of it. There's all sorts of dodges you could get up to have a second helping, but we won't go into that.
Can you describe the barracks in a bit more detail? You said there were 30 of you to one barrack.
You had what they call spiders. A spider is a collection of 8 barrack blocks that all converge on a centre ablution blocks, wash basins and bathrooms and so forth. And there are about, I don't know how many of these spiders on the camp altogether, because it was not only a radio school, it was a basic training school. So you not only had...
This Cranbourne you're describing.
No, this is Cecil Yatesbury. When I went to Cranwell, you were in barrack blocks there to start with, and then we moved on to ordinary wooden barrack rooms. But when we got up there, it was very, very cold again, and we had already been there a week before they decided to shut the camp down and send us on 10 days leave. When we got back, the weather was even worse, but they still didn't send us home again. They just sent us out in the countryside, armed with shovels, to clear the snowdrifts. Well, I was there for 5 months, passed the course. We were sent on leave, and depending on how much service you had left, it was decided whether you went overseas or whether you stayed in the UK.
How had you found the discipline of being in the area?
Oh, it's nothing like as severe as the army would have been. You couldn't misbehave too much, but it wasn't all that severe. There were all sorts of little dodges you got up to. It was a common thing that if you were walking around with a clipboard in your hand, looking important, you could get away with a lot. On a Saturday morning, we're usually involved in some sort of working parties. But we got into the dodge of a dozen of us forming ourselves up into a platoon, marching out the main gate, down the main road, to the local tea shop, and spend the morning there.
Were you with other National Service?
All National Service, yeah.
So you've done 10 months training.
10 months training.
After a 2-year National Service.
Yes.
Where were you sent after that?
Well, we were sent to Warrington. It was just the station where they organised drafts for overseas. We were, some of us, I say this class I was in, I suppose about 50% had to remain in the UK. The rest of us were sent to Warrington, and we were split into different drafts. One draft went to the Far East, and there were about 6 of us went to the Middle East. And we sailed from Tilbury on a ship called the Empire Windrush. We ended up in the canal zone at a transit camp. And from there, 3 of my friends were sent up to Palestine. And this was a time when the Arabs and the Jews were revolting and the British Army was the meat and the sandwich. So no one was very keen to go up there. But 3 of my friends went up there, and the rest of us were posted to Aden. Well, we were supposed to fly out the next morning, but during the day, the other 2 were taken off the flight to make way for officers and so forth. So I flew down to Aden without the other 2, but they caught me up in Aden. They came down by troop ship on the Georgic, I think it was.
And what were you doing in Aden?
Well, I started off at the headquarters in Aden Command. But they discovered that I shouldn't have been there at all. I should have been at the airfield. So I was posted up to the airfield, and I was servicing Tempest aircraft of 8 Squadron, Wellingtons of the transport section.
Leonard Vincent Knowles, Reel 2.
We had servicing Tempests of 8 Squadron, Wellingtons of the transport section, Ansons, and when the Wellingtons were scrapped, we had Dakotas. And there are also aircraft coming through in transit. Every now and again, something would come through on its way to Singapore, for instance. When the Singapore emergency started, they had great problems in Singapore with rioting and so forth. And we had this aircraft, this Lancaster came in on its way to Singapore, and it had this engine fault. So they had to send back to the UK for a spare engine for it. And we were told that in no event were the local Arabs to get anywhere near this Lancaster. And we couldn't understand why. But someone finally got to look inside there, and the whole aircraft was loaded then with tear gas grenades for riot control in Singapore. We had, it was 8 Squadron, the Tempest Squadron, was an active service unit. Inasmuch
that, that it was your squadron.
Well, I was station headquarters, but most of my work was concerned with 8 Squadron because we didn't have enough wireless fitters to go round. Station headquarters should have had their own section, 8 Squadron should have had their own section, and the transport people, but there were just two or three of us, and we had to do the lot. And I consider myself more or less semi-detached to 8 Squadron. As I say, they were an active service unit in as much as they were used in controlling the Aden Protectorate. Various tribes, various sheikhs and so forth would step out of line. And where they didn't have enough troops to control them, they used to threaten them with the RAF. And while I was there, I suppose we had about four or five of these actions wherein they would warn them that if they didn't comply, if they didn't stop raiding caravans, if they didn't pay their taxes, then they would be attacked. And they used to give them 24 hours warning and then go in after with them rockets and bombs. Seems pretty crude, but that's what happened.
Can you describe your job in a bit more detail and the structure of your, I would say organisation, but you know, you're a wireless fitter. Mm-hmm. How many of you were there? What was the hierarchy within?
We had a signals officer. We had a sergeant, two corporals, all wireless fitters. There were three wireless fitters and a couple of radar fitters. Now, as you pointed out just now, we had a 10-month course for a 2-year service. Well, they decided that 10 months was too long a period to use up. So they brought in the category of, not wireless fitter, radio mechanic. Now, radio mechanic was a Group 2 trade, as opposed to a wireless fitter being a Group 1 trade. And the radio mechanic only took a 5-month course. And he only specialised in either ground or air.